Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Tried Behavioral Health, covering trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a mental health perspective. Today's topic area is part of our Clinician Series podcast. In our regular podcast, we provide the coverage of a mental health topic of interest, and we find ourselves typically focused on the why behind or the why that drives the work being done in a specific area. The Clinician Series, however, is taking the discussion of topic areas a few steps further, specifically talking with experts not just about the why of their area of expertise, but we'll dive into a more practical, more hands-on, experiential understanding of the what and the how regarding the application of various therapeutic techniques, strategies, and constructs that we'll be presenting. The goal of the Clinician Series is to take our listeners behind the therapy door, to provide a look at and develop an appreciation for what actually occurs in the therapy session, including what gets said, patients' reactions, and the dynamic between the therapist-patient that can occur during the therapy hour.
Welcome to Behavior Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. I'm really excited about our show today as we're talking about one of my personal most favorite areas in psychology, and that's couples-focused work. To address this area, I've got Dr. Michelle Haley with me today. Michelle is the founder and director of Together Well. Together Well is a community of mental health professionals that offer emotional wellness workshops to individuals, organizations, and to families. Michelle has nearly two decades of experience in a variety of roles, including therapist, adjunct professor, researcher, community programmer, and case manager. She lives and practices out of the San Francisco Bay Area, and this work in the Bay Area has included facilitating intimate partner violence groups, referred to as IPV, for inmates at a correctional facility, creating IPV curriculum for the graduate school at the University of San Francisco, and she provides workshops for clinicians, the DA's office, and the police department to help equip those having to address an IPV incident. Michelle, welcome to Behavioral Health Today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you. Hey, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Michelle is a returning guest to our show, but today we're taking more kind of a clinical focus in our conversation as we're talking about couples therapy, romantic relationships, and some of the group work that she does around that. Michelle, give us a sense of the work you're doing within couples workshops.
Yeah, like you, I love couples therapy and workshops. And so currently I've curated so many workshops on how to increase healthy communication with couples, skill building. And it's just a wonderful addition to people who maybe aren't quite ready for therapy or have just started therapy to help build skills that really set that foundation in being ready to access and go deeper in therapy.
I really like that. I find that in my work too, much like what you're starting off with is communication, you know, we would say, well, that's going to be one of the most common areas to present with. And in fact, it is. Yeah. But it's not just communication. There's a lot around it, isn't there? Actually, when we look at communication, oftentimes I think that there's always two levels of communication going on. One's that there's a content, just kind of the day-to-day stuff. And then there's the process, kind of that more core dynamic being played out, that relationship dynamic for how relationships work, that sometimes for each individual, that pattern of how to relate predates the relationship that they're in, and it's unconscious.
Yeah.
And all these interactions are going on at one time with all this daily stuff, but sometimes we don't realize, man, there's a whole current down here. How do
Absolutely.
You help folks both at both levels? One with some of the skill building, which I love, which we kind of need. And then how do you help them maybe understand some of the more core, kind of deeper areas that are underlying some of the issues that they might be stuck on?
Yeah, great question. And you said that so well. And for me, like, I think it's like an infusion a bit of Gottman's work and Sue Johnson's EFT emotionally focused therapy work. Because with Gottman, it's really about identifying these different areas in the relationship that you might be doing and pairing skills to help that particular person work on addressing those particular areas. And then with Sue Johnson's work, like just to be able to notice the attachment patterns and see how the relationship dynamics are going. And then once a couple can see how that pattern's happening, they can add like these tools that they've learned to help break the pattern. And it becomes so fruitful and rewarding. And so I love the combination of both of those pieces of work together.
Yeah, the Gottman's work and Sue Johnson's work are brilliant components in this. In my work, I do some individual couples therapy. We also include the NVC, the nonviolent communication work, some of the communication piece. What am I observing? What am I feeling? What am I needing? Can I make a request? And so all these models being brought together can really be helpful. I know that we don't get together with people by mistake. It's not. There's kind of this almost unknown, unconscious draw that we get brought together with in people. And what we find sometimes in couples therapy, there's this elegant dysfunction that can only happen with a person that we're with. And if it wasn't that person, we would be finding somebody else. They might look different and have a different whatever, but it'd be the same dynamics playing out, wouldn't it?
Definitely.
What do you notice about that part?
Well, I'm just kind of chuckling to myself too, because I think about, we can all relate. We've all been in relationships, so we can all relate it even back to our own lives. And you think about the place you were in and maybe the pattern of men or women that you've dated in the past, and they're all sort of have these similarities. And so it was really about yourself sort of like examining what that was for yourself and making a choice, like I can either continue to date the same sort of pattern, or I could kind of change something within myself and choose a different partner.
I really like that emphasis right there of, I think what therapy does, it makes the unconscious conscious, one of the many things. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying right there is, what is it that draws me to certain relationships? We oftentimes refer to psychology to the repetition compulsion, where we are compelled to repeat those patterns of behavior, ideally looking to put a different ending on them, basically a new ending on a very familiar beginning. But it almost feels like sometimes with that repetition compulsion, we can insert that new definition of insanity, doing more of the same, hoping for a different outcome.
Right.
And what you're saying earlier, sometimes that's all we know. We don't know different levels of communication. We don't know maybe some of the core needs within us that could be driving things. So part of it sounds like you get to do is raise. Well, two things. One, to provide some really good communication strategies. And then secondly, to provide maybe an understanding of themselves and how they come together as a couple.
Yeah. And like what you're saying too, and really being able to delve in and think about, well, when we were doing couples therapy, is like kind of delving into like, well, how were you raised? What were the dynamics in the family? And oftentimes people are just sort of dating people that, this is, we joke around a lot in therapy, like about dating our mother or father, right. With theories, but it's kind of true, like in an attachment sense. Right. So, and so that's what feels normal to us. And so we pick partners that feel like what we're used to. And so until we can really like explore and analyze that and the environments in which we grew up in, we tend to just choose partners wearing a certain shade of glasses that we've been wearing our whole lives.
When you put it like that, when you say we're attracted to what we know, we do what we know until we know how to do better. In our families of origin that we're raised in, we know the culture in it. Yeah. We know how communication goes. We know how to react to things. And that's part of our paradigm. And so we look for paradigms that we are familiar with, kind of a culture, set of language, ways of being that we know, even though there are healthier, let's say health, just for the sake of conversation, healthier ways of being in relationship. That's not attractive to us because we don't know how to be in that. It's right. Uncomfortable, actually, sometimes even to be in something healthier, even though we might say, wouldn't you want to go there instead of here? But I know here.
Right. And I think that sometimes for clinicians, when they're working with couples and they see someone playing out this pattern, like for them, they can see it and they're like, but why won't you choose this? Yes. And just sitting with their own sort of acknowledgement and frustration with that too, that why aren't they choosing the healthier? That's something just to make sure when you're doing the work that you continuously check yourself.
That's a good reminder to us as clinicians, because sometimes we might be saying, well, wait a minute. You keep going through that over and over again, and we're beginning to name it, and you want to go back.
Right.
But what you're saying, I think, in a larger, more contextual way that really adds real meaning to it, you're going back because you're trying to put a different ending on a very familiar set of beginnings that you're experiencing with your partner now that were part of your upbringing, that attachment that you referred to early on. What I couldn't get around my core needs, my core desires, and my core wishes, what I couldn't get from my earliest caregivers back then, I find people now that resemble them. Little do I know it, but I do.
Right.
And I'm going after, everything in my life is organized by trying to get that core need met by somebody who mm-hmm. somehow reminds me of what I grew up in. Little do I know it again, because it's unconscious. But I'm right. going after something so very important in my life. And if I don't find it here, my next relationship, I'll find it in the next person, or I'll find a person where it reminds me of them to try and find the same thing. That's why the divorce rate goes from 50 to 70 to about 85. Uh-huh. Why? Because we find what we know. It's mm-hmm. exactly what you're saying here around that attachment, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, it's, it really is. You're dating essentially the same person because you think the yes. grass is going to be greener. Yeah. And then it's not, it ends up being the same person in a lot of sense. Exactly. Yeah.
But what you said is an important key. We're going to keep finding more of the same mm-hmm. until we ourselves understand what it is that draws me to more of the same.
Right.
And this contextual meaning or this contextual pattern that I notice with some appreciation. In fact, when we look at it this way, it takes away the judgment, because a lot of people say, good night, look at what I'm doing, you know, and they begin to go into that judgment piece, that shame piece, that guilt piece. But if we can reframe it for them and right size and say, hey, you're going after something very important, what you didn't get in your family of origin, let's say in your first family, you're going to be attracted to that, aren't you? So all these relationships and all the struggles make sense if we look at it through that a lens, like you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. and it kind of right-sizes it, kind of depathologizes it.
Exactly.
It actually gives them some sense of, you've been working really hard to go after something so very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that when clients are able to see that mapped out, it actually brings a lot of peace.
Yes.
And it's like, I actually, you know, don't necessarily have to work as hard as I think I have to work too. And so that's often like sort of this aha moment, just being yeah. able to see it mapped out right. and then really feeling like a sense of control over something yes. that has maybe felt really chaotic.
I really agree there. And I think in that moment, there is that hope that kind of goes, wait a minute, I don't have to stay at this level. I can come up here and do yeah. something at a different level. And I think that is very hope inducing and instilling. However, the question comes up, well, then that sounds really good. I'd like to do healthy, but I don't know how to do healthy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what comes into play when you're talking about some of the skill building, some of the emotional regulation, whether it's learning how to, you know, communicate in a different way, how to set boundaries. I'd like to hear more about that piece, because that's where the skill building piece comes into play. If I want to do healthy, I might need to develop some things that I've never learned before. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm not very comfortable with.
Yeah. So I would say the first part of that, usually for when I'm working with clients and especially like in big workshops and classes, it's really about helping people baseline identify I statements, being yes. able to say how they feel, what they need. And that part is so crucial, because a lot of times people, you know, whether it's the environments they grew up in, they weren't allowed to express how they felt. And so it really helping clients to expand their emotional vocabulary, because when you share how you feel, it disarms your partner. So if you're just said, you didn't do the dishes and blah, 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 blah. You know, if you say like, it makes me feel like, you know, coming up with a feeling word, it helps that partner understand the position. Yes. And so they're able to hear and process a lot more. And then with I statements, what I love about them is you're only talking about one issue. It's not what we call everything in the kitchen sink. You're not doing a laundry list of all the things that they didn't do that day or last Thanksgiving. You know, it's just like that one issue, because what ends up happening is people really get activated and they start to go into maybe like that fight or flight response. And so, you know, the frontal lobe sort of goes offline and fights can happen if you start listing out all the different things in which that person didn't do, because maybe doing the dishes triggered a bunch of other issues. And so I statements are so simple, but so powerful, because it really provides like a structure and a frame and how clients can communicate. And then the other piece of that is really saying like what the need is. And sometimes it's just saying, I don't know what my need is. I'll come back to you later. And people who haven't been used to voicing their needs, it can be really challenging for them to identify what that is, but to be able to just put a placeholder and say, I'll come back to you once I realize what the need is, or maybe the need is I need you to bring the dishes to the dishwasher. And that's just what it is in that moment. Like, great. As you mentioned about the underlying currents, sometimes it's really about a different need than the content surface need, right. Like you were identifying like these two different structures that are happening at play. So I statements, I love listening exercises. Everybody hates these, but they're so powerful. Because when we get into an argument, we're often like, you know, thinking about what we want to say next to combat what they're saying. And
almost
we're
like
not
we're reloading, isn't it? We're not even listening. Uh-huh. We're kind of reloading, kind of getting ready to come right back.
That's a great way to put it too. Yeah. It can feel that way. Yeah. So actually practicing what it is that the partner was saying and yeah. saying it back, which prevents them from formulating their next reply. And so you repeat it back and then the other party just basically says whether they said it right or not. And you keep going back and forth until, you know, it's correct. And I've seen couples go back like 6 times until they got like this one oh, I yeah. statement, you know? Oh, and yeah. so that can be really helpful, but there's a lot of really great tools out there that just like help create a nice baseline for what we were calling healthy communication.
Yeah, that is so good. I love that you're encouraging that before we can do the between work, we've got to do the within work.
Yeah.
And that within work is so very hard, harder than we can possibly truly imagine sometimes. It's like, well, what do you feel? Well, if you adjust, or what do you feel?
Right.
Well, I think that this should go, no, what do you feel? And sometimes just saying, no, what do you feel? What do you feel? Someone will stop. And that's not a poking moment. It's to help someone understand, man, I really have a hard time, don't I?
Right.
Identifying, naming then what I might be going through. And I like the idea that you're using these I statements. I is so very hard. They say that sometimes, well, they say that the word you may be one of the most aggressive, you know, words in a communication back and forth. And this idea that we can use these I statements and just stay with something very simple. I find like 95% of most conversations can have a good starting path that we can just stay with two things that you said, feelings and needs, FN, mm-hmm. FN, FN all the time. In fact, that's so important. The bottom left key on all of our computer boards is FN.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, that's how important it is. It's even got its own key on a keyboard that we use every single day. What am I feeling? What am I needing? And if I can just lead with that, but then I can do that within work first, and then the between work has a greater chance.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah. I think too, sometimes, you know, when we get in these fights, the fight, you know, to just use the word or the conflict, whatever it may be, the fight is really not between us and our partner.
No.
The fight is within ourselves.
Yep.
It might take 6 laps to get to a place where I've got to work down and kind of fight with myself to say, what am I really feeling and what am I really needing? Yeah. So I can make it clear to you as to what I do need so that I can set you up for success for really understanding me and not having to be defensive as I come at you with you statements. But to make it safe enough to hear what I want. Because if you're reloading, that just means you're feeling defensive.
Right.
And I'm not making it safe for you to listen to me. And that's part of my job too, isn't it? To make it so that you can be a good listener for me.
Right. And it's like, how do we help clients disarm themselves? Like you're talking about the loading. And so how do we disarm? And a big part of that, I think, is reminding couples that they are on the same team. And so when I do workshops, like part of the intro part of the workshop is I have all the couples come up with their team name. And then we refer to them as that team name. And like, of course, we want to keep their sense of individuality and all that. But like, it's just a reminder. For example, there was one team, they were co-pilots. So they were just each other's co-pilot. So then it's also a really nice way to remind them that they have something that they enjoy together, that they're on the same team. And so I also encourage too, like when they're going to have like a conversation or they need to remind their partner about something and they're honestly, truly in their heart, not trying to like criticize or nag or anything like that, you know, that they're like, hey, co-pilot, you know, XYZ, you know, as a orienting, anchoring frame.
Yeah.
And it actually works quite nicely.
That's really cool. I like that idea of reminding them that in many ways we are a team, we're together for a reason. And what I find, maybe you've seen the same thing, probably to the couple, every couple that I've seen, share a core need.
Mm-hmm.
It might look a little bit different and its origins are different in their first families, but that core need is coming together in a very kind of unique, kind of almost kind of reverent way. When you think about it, where I think about it, it's we're both going after something similar. Maybe we're coming at it differently. It might mean something a wee bit differently to us. But when we share the idea that, hey, we're both looking for the same thing, it kind of goes back to what you're saying is we really are a team here, aren't we?
Mm. Totally. Yeah. And that's so true because, like, you know, when I think about, there's this one particular couple that this reminds me of when you bring this up, and that's they both had this need to be appreciated. Mm-hmm. They both felt like the other wasn't appreciating them, but they both thought they were sort of doing things to show them that they were appreciated. So, for example, this was a heterosexual couple. The female in the relationship would cook for her partner and clean the house, and she felt like that was her way of showing her appreciation. And then the man in the couple, he said, I feel like it's obvious. Of course I appreciate you. It kind of felt like maybe he didn't need to express it so much. And so with this particular couple, it was about, I was essentially just becoming a translator to help them figure out in each other's language how to go about showing the appreciation, which was the need that they both had. And so in a way that they could both hear it, because it's like, that you could clean the house all day, but that's not going to show, you know? And so in this particular situation for the woman, it was about her actually vocalizing her appreciations to her husband. And for the man, for him, it was about, he wasn't a super verbal man. Like, it wasn't easy for him to like share appreciations, but he was a great writer. And so he was able to write post-it notes around the house for her to show her appreciation. It was super special because she'd just be like doing her thing and then find a post-it, you know, that said an appreciation. And so it really helped unite the relationship in a way. And then we were eventually able to like move on and come up with other ways. And like, for example, at dinner, they had gotten to a place where he had practiced appreciations, and every night for dinner, they would each share an appreciation for one another. And so it's really, you know, coming up with this way to fill the needs in a way that the others could hear. Yes. And a lot of times I think where couples make a mistake is they show appreciation in the way they think that they might want it.
Right.
Too, as opposed to how the other person actually hears it and digests it.
Yeah, I love what you're referring to, Gary Chapman's work, and kind of a way he talks about the five languages of love.
Oh, exactly.
And you're nailing it. You know, there's the language of the giving of gifts, acts of service, words of affection, physical touch, the gift of quality time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What you're talking about here is that here's this woman through an act of service. And oftentimes what we give and how we receive, sometimes it could be two different languages. You're saying for her showing her love is through the acts of service, the nice meals and the things she does. Mm-hmm. However, she receives the experience of being loved through words of affection. Hey, thank you for this. So that was a great meal, or whatever the words of affection may be that really meet. And sometimes we're loving our partner to death by cooking the great meals or doing these certain things, but we're missing each other. Mm-hmm. And that's where the frustration comes up. You never say, hey, I look pretty, or you never notice the things that I do, or you never spend quality time. And the person's thinking, yeah, but I'm doing all of these things over here. Right. I know, I see it. And while I know that's your love language, I would really love to see if we could build in maybe becoming bilingual with each other. And I love that you do that with them. Really good.
Yeah. And that particular book, that's a great resource for clients. And again, like they generally, it's like, again, like an aha moment. They had just not thought of that, matching that before. So great resource.
Yeah. Also for our listeners too, they make it's great for couples for sure. For clinicians. There's also one they have for teens and children too, I believe. Mm-hmm. That kind of helps us identify our love languages early. So basically when we're talking about a love language is, if I love you, I want you to experience the love that I have for you. And it's not yours to get, it's mine to find how you would experience that most clearly. I get to be responsible for getting you to experience that love I have for you, rather than saying, well, I'm doing this, this, and this, and you should be appreciative.
Right.
We can, but it's not going to work. Why not, if I'm feeling these things, find the conduit to, or the station or the channel that you're on, or the love language that you feel most attuned to. And I'm going to try and hit that every single time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I sometimes hear couples say, well, he's just doing that because I told him, you know, that would be meaningful to me. And I say, absolutely. That's why he's doing that. Now he knows in ways that he didn't know before. And can you see how hard he's working to love you?
Exactly.
So you can experience the love that he has, that he's just been missing the target, because he thought the target was over there to the left. And you're telling him, no, honey, it's over here to the right.
Exactly. And I love that. I love that frame that you're putting on it, because it's and see how hard they're working.
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that takes, you know, because of where the couple was coming from, like it does take a while for them. And that's where the teammate thing comes in, because it's like, we are on the same team, and it's such a a cognitive shift sometimes from thinking that you're not adversarial, you know? So
that's really a good introduction, isn't it? Because you're kind of shifting their frame of, we've been so adversarial all these years. And sometimes our identity becomes more and more forged in that identity of conflict. And then to introduce this team, you know, this kind of this team approach, we're teammates, we're sharing the same need, we've got different ways to communicate this. And it begins to shift that contentious view of ourselves into something that says, hey, maybe we're both going after the same thing in ways that we just didn't realize. That paradigm begins to shift, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's beautiful. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Continuing education is both a requirement and a learning opportunity, but finding the right CE provider can be challenging. AATBS, a triad company, offers continuing education for psychologists, social workers, marriage and family therapists, counselors, and behavior analysts. CE courses are available both individually and as part of our new All Access Pass. All Access Pass provides a library of over 250 unique courses. That's more than 800 hours of CEs, with new courses being added every month. As a special offer, Behavioral Health Today listeners can save 15% on CE purchases. Visit us at aatbs.com/BHT and enter promo code BHT15 during checkout. That's aatbs.com/BHT. Check out our library and check off your CE requirements today.
Let me just kind of throw out another question here. Trauma is often part of what we see couples coming in with. And it could be trauma secondary to, you know, an attachment failure early on, someone not getting what they need. And again, we're making this aware to them, making their unconscious conscious about what they're in and what they're going after so they can begin to get more control, like you said earlier. And so there can be trauma in unmet needs that way. There could be other traumas along the way too. How do you find yourself addressing individual trauma within the context of your couple's work and workshops?
Yeah. So with workshops, generally, if there's a lot of trauma that's involved, I often think it's important that clients have been in therapy, their own private therapy, to be able to process their trauma, because what we don't want to happen is in sort of like a surface, like, because workshops tend to be like more surface based, they're less in depth, like of therapy. Yeah. And so it depends on the situation, because the workshop may or may not be appropriate depending on the content of that particular workshop or what the patient's going through. But when there is a lot of trauma involved, I do really recommend that the couple is in individual therapy if they're also embarking in couples therapy with their partner, because there's going to be a lot that they'll probably need to process. It might not be safe in the couple session for them, or, you know, there could just be a variety of different contexts where it might be just not safe.
What you said earlier really kind of supports this right now. And I love the way you're framing it. You said earlier, you know, when we're in a trauma state, we know that we are literally activated. MRIs will show that our brain is lit up, our fight or flight's being taken off, those parts of our brain, like the frontal lobe that you referred to earlier, where we kind of think and break things down. It's offline. It's not working in that moment. In that moment, in that fight or flight moment, in my activation, I am being hijacked by whatever is going on in the moment, but it's hijacked by whatever my trauma in the past may be. And I can't come into that moment as, well, really the way that I would like to, the way that would be therapeutic and kind of corrective maybe in that moment. So what you're saying I love is that if we get to realize that we do have some traumas, we all have some to some degree. Mm-hmm. And in those moments of trying to listen or trying to convey something or take some risks about how I'm feeling, it does put into jeopardy us being potentially hijacked and activated. So I like that idea, that individual therapy, allowing us to work through that past trauma, understand how we've always protected ourselves, you know, in order to stay safe, but how that very way we stayed safe is in fact interfering with my working with you to get to a different ending and that more healthy therapeutic ending.
Yeah. And I do think it's so crucial. And we do psychoeducation around like the frontal lobe. So like when, you know, you get into that fight or flight and your frontal lobe goes offline and, you know, you're not able to think straight or have your insight and abstract reasoning and judgment intact. And so you may say things that are actually more damaging to the relationship. Yeah. And so, and that's a good opportunity for like one of the skills, which is timeouts for a couple if, you know, they notice within themselves that they're feeling activated. So a first part of that is really having the couple be able to identify, yeah. are you being activated? And so whether that's teaching them, you know, like 1 through 10, where are you on mm-hmm. sort of like a scale, but coming up with what a timeout. And so with the timeout, it's really about either couple can call a timeout and the other partner has to respect it. They can't be like, no, you're staying put right. until we finish this. Anyone can call a timeout. And it could be, if you and I are in a relationship and I can tell that you're getting activated and I'm not, I can call a timeout. So it doesn't have to be that I'm getting that it's personally me. And so I also try to have the couple come up with a gesture. So just kind of talking more about them having a common language, because if someone calls the time out, it can kind of feel like, I don't want to say like punitive, but yes, like, you know, the reason why I kind of didn't want to say punitive is just because some couples actually do like the time out and that works yes. for them. But then for other couples, it's like a peace sign, yes. like peace yeah. or coming up with a gesture that makes them feel like they can get on it more on board. And then they come up with an agreed upon time, yeah. whether that's 10 minutes or a half hour, but there's sort of this understanding that during that time out, they're both taking time to kind of increase that parasympathetic nervous system by doing diaphragmatic breathing, progressive yes. muscle relaxation, meditation, all these things so that their frontal lobe can come back online and then they can reconvene and have the conversation. And the idea is that if they get activated again, it's back to timeout again yes. until they can, you know, kind of resolve yeah. the issue. And it's a lot of work. I mean, that's not easy. A lot of couples get really frustrated with that in the beginning and it can take a while, but it's really helpful. And another thing is that couples don't leave because that can trigger abandonment too. A crucial part of that is coming up with the time frame and not leaving it open-ended. So both yeah. parties know we're coming back at 10:45.
Yeah, those are terrific strategies. They really are. I think it emphasizes when I'm activated, I am not my best self. Things are offline that need to be online for me to work through this. And my main task in this moment, and again, the fight is within myself in that moment, not between you anymore.
Right. Yeah.
And I've got to do that. I've got to, and I like the parasympathetic nervous system, paramedic. What do paramedics do? They make us feel better. How can we do that? We can take some time out. We can breathe, turn that fight or flight off, get those other things back online. And then I can walk through these things much more productively, much more therapeutically, much more informed about what is going on for me. And I get to be responsible for my moment of being hijacked. And I love what you're also saying too, Michelle, around if I need to part from you because I'm being hijacked, I just can't walk out because that could trigger maybe your abandonment fears or your history of, see, every time I get into a good conversation, people leave me or they walk out, or maybe they feel like it's being weaponized against them. So the idea of having a healthy separation of, hey, I am really being hijacked right now. Yeah. And like you said earlier, I don't want to make things worse. Can I take 10 minutes? I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to do some breathing. I'll come back and maybe we can get our arms around this together once I kind of ground myself. That makes it safe for the person to say, hey, you take all the time you need. I'll be here. I'll have a soda ready for when you come back and we'll sit down and we'll kind of sort through this together. Love
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And the thing about it too is it's just, you know, like a tool that just, you need to do it when also you're not activated.
Yeah.
So that when you are, you're not like sort of like, well, screw you, I'm not doing that. You know, it's something that kind of is like has to sort of be practiced like when yes. you're not at that super escalation part yet and decided upon when both of your frontal lobes are intact.
Yeah. I kind of sometimes liken it to the roller coaster ride and you see the, you know, the roller coaster car going click, 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 click up to the top. Yeah. And ideally we can stop it early because once you go over the hill, you're along for the ride as long as that traumatic ride lasts until you kind of end up in the wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. So we can catch it early. And what I love is that you're providing people kind of with what their own activation signs are. What is it when you know that you're being hijacked? Well, how would you recognize that? Maybe you're feeling tense. Maybe your voice gets louder. Maybe your pace gets quicker. Maybe you're feeling uncomfortable. We can just notice one of those early warning signs, because we all have them, either within ourselves. And what I love is what you're saying is maybe even notice it for your partner. Hey, honey, it looks like you're getting a little worked up here. And I so want to kind of steward that right now. You want to take a time out. You want to take a little bit of space. We'll come back, and making it safe for the person to do so. So I love what you're saying here, catching it early.
Yeah. And like you said, like the partner is generally the one who does notice the cues of the other person first, you know? And so that's why that piece is so delicate, because if that person's already getting amped and then someone's like, well, you're getting like this, that's why it's just so great to have like, okay, we're doing a peace sign. It's time out, you know?
Yes.
And so there's like not even really a discussion. It's just, we're doing it, because that can easily start a fight also.
Yeah. That's really, good. Really good. Michelle, we're kind of winding down on our time, but I want to ask you just two more quick things, just kind of short answers, if you would. What do you find to be the most challenging and yet rewarding part of your couple's work?
Yeah, there's a lot to both. As a couple's therapist, you really are rooting for the couple. And but sometimes couples therapy is about helping them break up. You know,
sometimes.
And so you're kind of breaking up, not, you know, in a boundaried sense, of course, but like, you know, just in terms of like, you're doing all that work together and there's a lot of pain for the couples and going their separate ways. So I would say that's a really challenging space, but in terms of—
Can I comment on that just real quick?
Oh yeah.
I think there is a place which my colleague and I refer to it as kind of a therapeutic uncoupling.
Yes.
And there are sometimes when people exhaust all their best efforts— And they get to a place where it's not about blame anymore. It's about a greater understanding and appreciation for themselves and the other person. And they say, hey, you know what? I love you. Hey, I love you.
Yeah.
But maybe this isn't the best fit for us. Maybe that we thought it once was. Right. And maybe we're going in different directions, but we get to do it in a therapeutic way, not a rupturing, painful way. And we get as therapists to say, hey, maybe we're shifting gears here now, aren't we? Maybe we're moving to maybe more therapeutic uncoupling, as I mentioned earlier. Maybe I can help facilitate that process with you in a way that actually we might even be able to grow from that uncoupling as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to call it breaking up better. And I like therapeutic uncoupling. And there is sort of this like beautiful thing that emerges because both parties really do grow from that.
Yeah.
And so that they can learn the tools from this relationship for their next. And so that is really beautiful. And so oftentimes goodbye isn't always good. And so it's interesting that it's goodbye. And so I really like what you're saying, because you're really helping the couple, you know, like you said, like not have this eruption, and that it's like a goodbye on like a really respectful and loving terms, because you loved this person at one point and throughout the relationship. And so it's just a shifting. And I like how you said that.
Yeah. I really like that. In addition to that, what do you find to be most rewarding in the couple's work that you do?
Yeah. So I would say, and there's so many things that are rewarding, but at the end of a session, when you see that the couple has connected, and it's not just the content, but it's their physical body language, like the turning in, the matching in tone, like just that you see that they're having a genuine connection, that for me just warms my heart, you know? And then there are the other things, like after you do couples therapy and they go on and you don't see them again, like you're rooting for them. You're hoping things are going well for them. But in the rare circumstances, when you cross paths in the street and you see they're still together and they're, you know, smiling and happy, like that's also really wonderful too. That's rare when that happens, but it happened to me a couple of times and I'm always like, yes,
I love that
for you guys.
You know, I would agree. There's something that I've noticed too. Sometimes in a session, they'll come in and boy, it's palpable, the things you can feel going on. But then over the course of the session, you find these things kind of de-escalating and getting a little bit slower, a little quieter, a little bit better pace. People are listening more. People are talking from that I place, the within work before they do the between work. And it's almost like this reverence, kind of sacredness kind of comes into that moment, isn't there? And there's like this different sense of kind of knowing each other that kind of transcends what they're so used to. And so typically kind of locked in and locked up in, they begin to kind of transcend that and almost kind of look down into where they were and then into now where they get to be. It's a pretty cool place.
Love it.
Yeah. Michelle, I know we're kind of winding down, but if you were to cast some hope for the couples listening and for those therapists that might be working with couples, but particularly for the couples that are listening, cast some hope about what they can achieve in their life, if they can just lean into some couples therapy and what they might be able to expect as they come out of it.
Yeah. So when I think about, well, hope for patients, it's really about trusting the process. And sometimes it's going to get hard in the sessions, and just give it time. Because oftentimes, you know, sometimes when things get hard, again, like with that frontal lobe going offline, we kind of want to like stop the process or terminate, but just trust the process and ask questions too, and let your therapist know what your experience is, because that's how you get through, you know, and that's, you have to go through, you can't go around, unfortunately.
That's right.
You know, and for therapists, I would just say part of our role when we work with any patient is to hold hope. And so we're holding hope for the couple, and it doesn't matter necessarily what the outcome is, but we're just holding hope that we're helping them towards their process.
Really good. Really good. Thanks for sharing that hope. I appreciate that. Hey, as we close, I love folks to come and find you both together. Well, maybe you personally for some of your therapeutic work that you're doing.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different resources out there to help support couples. I would say, you know, the book that you were mentioning about love languages, that's a really great resource.
Mary Chapman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hold Me Tight by Sue Johnson. It's a really great book for illuminating different stories and cases. There's also another book. I think everybody probably already has this on their bookshelves, which is The Seven Principles of Making Marriage Work by the Gottmans. And then there's just like other, you know, just resources to just have for those situations where issues around intimate partner violence come up, you know, checking out APA resources. John Gottman has written some work. Futures Without Violence is a really wonderful resource. And they actually have a, on their website, what's nice is there's actually an exit door. So if there was somebody in an IPV relationship, they could click out the door and it just goes to a Google page. And there's other types of resources like the Aspire app, which looks like a news type of app, but it really has domestic violence resources. So if a perpetrator were to scroll on the phone and see it, it just looks like a news app. Like nobody would know that it was domestic violence. And then there's another page called, it's kind of a funny name, but it's called the Hot Peach page. And it's a great way for people to find domestic violence shelters in their area. So if you're a clinician and you need to give resources, that could be an option for you. So severe assault decreases by 60% when people are able to access domestic violence shelters. So just to have those resources. And then if you're looking for workshops on learning about couples counseling or workshops for patients about couples communication, if you go to togetherwell.org and you type in couples, different workshops or people who could provide workshops pop up. And Togetherwell, like was mentioned before, helps market workshops. So if you're a clinician who wants to offer a workshop on couples communication or a couples related issue, you could showcase your workshops on our platform, and it's free for clinicians to join.
Great.
There's no membership.
Yeah, I love that part. I love what you're doing with Together Well and making it an access. You know, you talk about how education is not a privilege, it's a right. And I so love what you set up out of that, just kind of that belief in life that here's what we get to provide folks with. There's no charge. I know it's a kind of a service of your heart, but what a great access for therapists to come in, teach some folks, and for folks to have access to this in ways that can be very, very meaningful. You know, I love these times, you know, part of our clinician's theories gets to be us kind of therapeutically kind of nerding out together, you know, and kind of just geeking away here as therapists and talking shop, and how fun it is to do so with you today, Michelle, around this topic of couples work. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been great to be with you again.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. I can't believe the time's up already. We'll have to do a part two.
I would love that as well. Thank you again. And to our listeners, we want to thank you for listening in as always, and we'll look forward to having you join us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tried Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.